good evening, and good streaming. I am Jello Biafra, and this is Renegade Roundtable. Last year, one of my favorite things that went down all year was, I saw history being made at a musical endeavor I had never, ever even seen anyone attempt before. I'd never even been to a show at that legendary outdoor venue Red Rocks in Colorado before, and finally got back there for this because King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard played three shows, almost 3 hours each, with a 15-minute break in the middle. Not one song repeated. And even the third show, if I had not seen the first two, I would have been really happy with that show. I was anyway. I think the first one was my favorite, but I was just amazed at how good all of them were. And for anybody who knows this band, who is rising by leaps and bounds, the musical directions go all over the map. I got drawn in with an album called Mind Fuzz because there was a lot of Hawkwindy things in there, which I'm kind of a sucker for, but then I find out, oh my god, they have all these other albums out, there's all these people who are into them, where was I? And so, and sometimes they'll put out, oh, a mere 5 albums a year or something like that, and no two of them sound the same, and good at all kinds of instruments per person, all kinds of different songwriting, and a disproportionate amount of the songs are credited as written, produced, recorded, and mixed all by one guy, and not just one kind of song, Stuart McKenzie. So guess who's here with us now? Stuart McKenzie. Thanks for coming on, mate. I'm very honored you'd do this.
G'day, Jello, and thanks. You're way too kind to me. Thanks for coming to all the shows and having me on your podcast.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean you kind of sort of become my favorite band after all this. I mean, you know, so many different places to go, so many different cool things. Obviously, I like some of the albums more than other ones, but how many more do you have in the can since you got home from tour?
We don't have any in the can right now. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we sit on them for a while. Over the years, I've tried to figure out how to not sit on them for very long because, you know, it's hard sitting on a record that's done. You get sick of it by the time it comes out. So we've tried to shorten that period where it's done and it isn't out as much as possible so you don't start second-guessing anything.
Within pressing plants taking forever to make the records and stuff.
Well, yeah, that's an issue which, you know, we have no solution for, but nothing you can do about it. But we are working on 2 records kind of simultaneously at the moment. They're kind of linked thematically, but opposite to each other as well. Kind of been a nice project.
Musically opposites as well, or?
I'd say genre-wise opposites, but sharing some musical motifs. And so, yeah, thematically too opposite. They both kind of tell a story, a bit of a narrative, but and they're kind of a unique sort of narrative to each other, but there's tie-ins and they're all kind of, I've been calling it like a yin-yang kind of thing. So
right,
they're sort of
right,
part of the same whole, but they're quite opposite as well.
Much. I think this is not your first yin-yang rodeo either, is it? Or is it?
Well, not. We have done this kind of thing a bit, but never to this sort of a level of being kind of linked and working on 2 things at the same time. That we made KG and LW, which were together. They were like a right, like a double right, album split in half, and we made, yeah, Fishing for Fishies and Infest the Rat's Nest sort of simultaneously, and they were really different to each other, but these are more linked than that.
Well, that when you are making that many albums at once earlier on, Fishing for Fishies, if I recall, is one of the more mellow ones, and Infest the Rat's Nest is the full-on heavy metal album all the way through, and that's interesting, you were doing both of those at the same time. So do you come up with songs, do you kind of put them in mental piles or folders? This might go on this kind of an album someday. This might go here. Or do you set out ahead of time, now we're going to make a metal album, but Fishies is not going to be a metal album?
Yeah, I think it's a little of both. And for me, I'm usually probably in one of 2 modes. I'm either in like a throwing shit at the wall mode, and I'm just riding, I'm just limbs flailing, yeah, just doing anything, yeah, and everything. Yeah. A lot of the time I'll be doing that if I don't know what the next project is, and I'm just trying stuff and just trying to find that spark of inspiration. And then as that sort of progresses, you know, I might have two ideas that feel like they're similar to each other, and they could be siblings or cousins on the same record. They could be kind of bunched together. And then as it sort of forms, or a record sort of forms, or multiple records kind of form, then you sort of go into the other mode of creating more songs for the, creating more children for the, you know, for the record.
Right, right. So you're working on two. Are there more already conceived and mostly laid out or not?
No, I'd say at this stage, we have some ideas for what we'd like to do next, but it's kind of like, it's kind of like, oh, we should make a record like this, or wouldn't it be fun if we had these kind of songs at a show, or this particular song, which is a bit of an oddball on a record that we have, is, has been really fun to play. We should make some more songs like that or something. But that's kind of as far as we go beyond what we've kind of got inside.
Right. Because night two at Red Rocks, you opened with a really good anthemic glam rock song.
Oh yeah, what was that? I can't remember anymore.
I can't remember the title either, but I was just listening. I figured someday maybe I could link it all up with titles and albums if I had a day or two to sit down and fix it all. Yeah, it would have done the Sweet or Slade proud. I mean, no surprise. You write all well into all these other genres, so maybe. So I guess it doesn't sound like we're going to get a whole glam rock album or a Neo Stooges one even anytime soon.
Neo Stooges would be cool. I'd go for that. No, yeah, I don't know. It's sort of weird to think about us making records from a perspective of genre. I mean, it's never really the way we've thought about it. I think we're just kind of music fans. Like if you just looked in any of our record collections, it's just kind of what we listen to, and it feels like the natural extension to make music like that. And obviously that is the way that people consume it, or the way people think about it is, you know, this record is this kind of genre, but that's not been the way that we've thought about it. Not that it's bad to think about it like that, but...
Because one of you, when you were in San Francisco and I saw you there, and Infest the Rat's Nest came out at that show, oh yeah, the next one's going to be a metal album. So somebody was looking at that. It might have been Ambrose Kinney Smith, the keyboardist, saxist, and soul singer extraordinaire in the band, who said, oh yeah, with all these new albums, we made an electronic one too, you know, which might have been Butterfly 3000, in some people's minds. I don't know. So if you're throwing stuff against the wall, which sounds like it's independent of the other band members, if you're trying to get stuff to bring in and jam on or not jam on and just do it, I don't know. It seems like you construct songs in a number of ways. Do the ideas come into your head, the melodies first, and then you find them on the guitar or a keyboard and flesh it out from there? Or do you find them by playing around on your guitar and then, oh, this sounds good, maybe I'll do this? Which way, or do you do both?
I think that over the years that's changed a lot. When I first started writing, I didn't think about lyrics or the way the construction of language or really what I was kind of talking about very, very much, a little, but it was less important than the melody and the way the kind of melody interfaced with the rhythm and the chords and stuff. And that was what I was interested in.
And so the melody was in your head and then you made the chords? Or
I think it would happen still both ways. It would it would happen tinkering around on a guitar. It would probably still happen both ways. Sometimes a melody first and sometimes kind of the chords first and find it. But what was important was the architecture of the construction, you know, like the rhythm and the way the melody rhythmically fit into everything had to fit like a puzzle and make sense to me at least. And that was the way like most of the earlier kind of songs were written. But then over time, it has been really important to experiment with the process. And almost every record that we've made has involved trying to write in a way that feels really uncomfortable or really hard or alien or something.
Yeah, there was an interview from a site, Total Guitar, which might be connected with Guitar World, guitarworld.com, where you said, I'm a big believer in writing on an instrument you don't feel comfortable on.
Yeah.
And you like piano because you could sketch parts for three people at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. I don't feel like I write a lot of songs on guitar anymore, actually. I still always play the guitar live, and I love it. I feel easily most at home on guitar. I probably will never in my life feel as comfortable making music on any other instrument. But I find it harder to write on guitar than in other instruments. And I don't think it's the guitar's fault. I think it's just the way I've learnt to play it, and my mind is kind of stuck in certain patterns already. And I feel like I've already explored a lot of them. So, yeah, even kind of thinking words first or the singing, because I don't feel like I'm a natural singer in a lot of ways. That's always felt like something I had to work on and just think about. It doesn't come naturally like the guitar does. So that's right. been a lot of fun to kind of focus on that.
The only thing I'm good for is the voice. I've never been any good at instruments, but I just have all these ideas, so I sing them to people. So everything starts in my head and needs to be transposed by my colleagues whose patience I try to no end with this, because then we got to find a key and make it all work and make all the parts fit and things like that. And sometimes it doesn't fit their music theory training at all. You know, the chorus for California Uber Alice, which came to me kind of through Japanese kabuki music of all things, it's not a normal music theory pattern.
And that's really interesting to me.
It took months for Klaus and Ray, and then our first drummer, Bruce, who went by Ted, to get it right. And finally, it made perfect sense once they did.
I love that, Jello, and I feel like that's part of the reason why the Dead Kennedys recordings were more like compositionally interesting than a lot of the other shit around at the time, I think. Would you say that's right?
Well, I was trying for that, and the whole band was trying for that. I mean, Ray and Klaus are over 10 years older than me and did not come from as much as a punk background as I did, but had all these other areas of knowledge, including, you know, they were really good musicians, which I thought would be a hindrance, but it was the opposite at the end of the day. And when I discovered surf instrumentals and things, they could already play them. So that became part of it too. And hardly anybody outside of Radio Birdman was doing that. And a lot of our best songs had more than one writer at the end of the day. And the one true group written one was Holiday in Cambodia. And there's some other jams I would take back and add some more parts and bring it back in, including Moon Over Marin, which was mostly Ray. But yeah, all kinds of different things. And you know, and also being like you, I guess, very wide, always widening my musical tastes and interests. You know, magic accidents can even come from a, you know, what some people might dismiss as cocktail jazz or something, but now it's called exotica, like Martin Denny or Les Baxter. And years after acquiring it just because it looked old, I went back to my parents' house and played the Atlantic's Bombora album, that amazing Australian surf instrumental band who don't sound like any other surf instrumental band anywhere. And all kinds of stuff began dancing in my head that had nothing to do with the melodies on the record. Sometimes a harmony or something better kicks in, then you turn it off and you flip out of the Walkman and just go with it that way. Okay, back to Red Rocks. Three shows, three different sets, all played with real tightness and fire. It was not like you hadn't just rehearsed it again that day. How many of these songs do you have up your sleeve that you could just pull out and play at any time?
First answer is we have had to abandon a certain dedication to tightness, actually, in order to be able to do stuff like this. I think if I go back to 2017 or 2018, where the band was at that point, well, let's say 2016, 2017, we were trying to be tight and we weren't playing different sets every night, and we were trying to construct a set which was really considered and just fucking blew your head off and was just 100% energy. And then we were gone. And that was really fun to do. But I think, at least in the mode we're in at the moment, it's been trying to abandon tightness and trying to just listen to each other a little bit more and vibe and just improvise, let things stretch out where they want to stretch out and keep things short when they should be short too. But I think on that tour, we were playing about 100-120 songs maybe. But that doesn't mean that we could play them on command at all times. There are some songs we'd comfortably go in with no rehearsals and just figure it out. You know what's happening 3 seconds ahead. That's all you need to know, and your brain figures it out in front of you. But there are a lot of songs where we need a sound check. And, you know, we need that hour or whatever it is before the show to just...
Yeah, well, one of the Red Rocks people told me you were working on 3 or 4 of them before the second show at sound check, trying to get them nailed back down. But I didn't know which ones those were. They all, as I said, they all took off. They were well played. They had fire, you know, and maybe it was Cavs or others said they felt you'd definitely gotten tighter with the current lineup. And I did think that the ante of the live energy and, yes, the tightness going into that was higher at the Red Rocks shows. It's like, oh my God, they were already so good. I flew out for these shows, and I never do fly to any but shows except Magma. But this is noticeably better than the San Francisco shows. They're even better than before. So,
thanks, Jello. That's real nice.
Not because you were less tight, but because you were more tight.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, in my mind, at least my definition of tight, and this, I'm probably thinking about hitting the notes on my guitar in time. I'm doing it a lot less, you know, and I'm making a lot of more mistakes, and I'm going off the script a lot more, and I'm playing
riffs. Oh, yeah, gee whiz, that was so noticeable. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah. yeah, I think... maybe the main difference from that time when you saw us in San Francisco, 2019, I reckon.
Yeah.
I think we're taking a lot more risks and we're just prepared to just go out into outer space a little bit further now and get a bit weirder, and we're happy to kind of like push the audience a little bit. Doesn't always work. Just
I think everybody
test people.
I think you've got an audience eager to be pushed. And the only one where it got a little lost, and one of you, it might have been Ambi again, I'm not sure, said afterwards, yeah, well, this was an experiment, was the Boogie song, I think, on night 2, that seemed to last about 20, 25 minutes when it could have been cut in half or more. And they're saying, yeah, it was an experiment, you know, we might not do it that way again.
Yeah, that's the nature of it, you know, it's just... You got to kind of be prepared to, sometimes you get into a rhythm and you're just like, shit, I got to get out of this. But you're kind of stuck into it.
Somehow manage to pull people out, or somebody does at different times, when it's not just one really gifted guitar player, but 2 or even 3. And then there's Ambi on the keys, and, you know, and Cook Craig is on both keyboards. And often it seems 3rd or the rhythm guitar that fleshes everything out when you and Joey may be soloing or playing off of each other, and he anchors more in with a bass. I don't know. But he doesn't always do that. So, and I'm sure Cookie had his harmonica out during the Boogie at some point, too. But, so now we will rewind further. You can see the thing swirling on the screen, maybe. What created you?
What is an interesting way to put it? Let's elaborate. What do you mean by me? Do you mean King Gizzard? Do you mean me? I mean...
Let's start with you.
The most basic way to answer it is my mum and my dad. But I'm definitely a product of my parents. They're both sweethearts. And I grew up in a household with a lot of, music, and art was always very much... encouraged, and we're always encouraged to be creative and stuff like that. I also grew up in a small town, like a small kind of country town, and I think I got
that was Anglesey, right?
Anglesey, yeah. And as I got a little bit older and started getting into music, I mean, I didn't pick up a guitar until I was 15, but I was very much into music and into art and being creative and stuff at that age. I think I got really bored, like really bored. And you know, from the moment that I moved to Melbourne, where there was kind of music scene happening, and made lots of friends. And, you know, from that point, it was just all I've really done since then is play music. You know,
Did any of the other Giznots grow up in Anglesey too? Were you schoolmates, or did you all meet later?
There was no high school in Anglesey. So I went to high school in Geelong. And I actually went to high school with Cookie. I met him there, which was cool. Lucas grew up in Geelong too. So we sort of met in Geelong circles. I must have met Cookie when we were about 14, maybe 13, something like that. Lucas maybe about 15. Ambrose grew up in a small town in the same kind of area too, and Ambrose and Lucas played in a band together when they were kids. And and I played in the band with Cookie too, so when we were all kids. So we used to sometimes play shows together. This is when we were like teenagers, you know, and that sort of thing. Yeah. And at that time it was a reason to be able to get into the pub, actually. Really. It was like, we can get into the pub and we can try to sneakily drink some beers and no one's gonna notice and stuff, and like that was all just big fun and games.
It sounds like your parents, you say they were very encouraging, they didn't mind having a creative kid and were able to handle a really bright kid and or kids. It sounds like you have siblings too.
Yeah, I have a little brother too. And yeah, we had a really good childhood, honestly. It was real fun and real happy, and it was just free. You know, it was quite a free, I don't know if they would describe themselves as hippies, but they kind of...
I was about to ask that.
I don't know if they would describe themselves as that, but definitely other people would describe them as hippies.
What were their occupations?
Dad worked a few different jobs, a lot of different jobs when we were kids, but he worked for an environmental organization, doing greeny stuff, and then he worked for...
Never have enough of that.
Yeah, I agree. And then he worked for the local water supply company, and then after that he worked for the local kind of council in small local government. And mum's a nurse. So, you know, pretty regular folks.
And your father taught you to play guitar upside down.
You've definitely done your digging. Definitely done your digging. Yeah, so dad played guitar left-handed. I have told this story quite a few times, but it is a nice anecdote. He learnt to play when my brother and I were kind of born. He didn't kind of grow up playing, and it was sort of he always talked about it as a meditative thing, music as a relaxation thing, which I never got as a kid because that's never what music was. Now music can be that for me a bit, but music was like a energy. It was a rev up thing for me. It was just like let's get some, I don't know, let's go crazy and like headbang and stuff. That's what it was when I was younger. But music was like a meditation for dad, and so he would sing my brother and I to sleep every night. But he'd be learning songs from a little songbook, and they'd be mostly Americana folk songs, stuff like that in that canon.
Pete Seeger maybe, or Bob Dylan probably.
Yeah, Dylan and Neil Young, and even like, you know, Cat Stevens and a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, my parents had a great big book of American folk songs collected and then turned into sheet music and stuff by Alan Lomax, so I'm assuming you're familiar
with. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, big, thick book, and I flipped through it once as a teenager when I was finally open to, if they like it, maybe I can even like it too, which is not normal, but although we all bonded on Carl Orff, the classical composer. They were mainly classical people. But I saw in that book, there was House of the Rising Sun. It wasn't an original by the Animals at all. It went much, much, much further back. So then when I was getting ready to cover that, which I've done with two or three people now, I Mom, where's that book? Where's that book? Oh, I threw it away. Trying to pare down after my father died so I don't have to do all of it when we have to empty the house later. But, that book is gone. Yeah. Oh, no. Another thing I blundered into is, I say, anything besides press releases or whatever, if I Google King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, there's not a lot on there. But one thing that did pop up was a video of four of you, maybe, which would be Cavs and probably Lukey. It was an early exam at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, where you were, I guess, working on Bachelor of Contemporary Music degree, or maybe all of you were.
There we go.
And have you seen this? There's hardly anybody in the room, and it's total garage rock.
I have seen this, and it has been shared around the band's chats quite a few times. It's only recently surfaced, I think, this video, and it is cool to see. Honestly, for me, it's like sort of at the same time I can't take my eyes away, and it's also really hard to watch and feels makes me feel weird, like old and shit.
Well, what's also interesting is even then it was two drummers.
Yeah, it was then. It was two drummers.
Eric Moore is on another Tom drum, or maybe one that was also being used by Michael Cavana, Cavs. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
But it was sort of fluid lineup for a long time, and it was also a side project, you know, for a couple of years at least. It was everyone's second project. Everyone had at least one more important band than King Gizzard.
Oh, what was yours?
Well, I had a couple. I played in a band with Lucas and with Cavs as well, called The Houses. And we played kind of, I don't know, it was psychedelic, but it was maybe a bit more indie or something. I also played in a straight up kind of psych band. Probably biggest influence was the video of Santana at Woodstock.
Love that.
Yeah, me too. And
greatest concert movie ever made. And I'm amazed how many people, even of my generation, let alone a little younger, have never seen it.
Well, I think I saw that when I was first learning guitar, and with this band called Al Mac and Jack that we played in, we just used to watch it over and over again. Yeah. And we had some other influences, of course, but I think that was the... If anyone ever asks what we sounded like, I always say, yeah, we tried really hard to sound like that.
But that movie, the editing and what they did with all the different cameras were in Santana. Somebody had a camera only on the hands of the one or two hand percussionists or the timbales player, and that was it. So every once in a while, they did a lot of split screen or even quadruple screen. You'd see Carlos or one of the others or one of the keyboards, but then you'd see the hands and only the hands from time to time, too. It was just amazing, that kind of stuff. I mean, the two that are my favorite from that, as you might guess, you know, rekindling my Cinderella ambition to try and get on stage and sing or something, was The Who.
Yep.
And above all others, Sly and the Family Stone.
Oh, yeah. Huge.
Huge.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Huge. Oh, yeah.
I watched that a lot as a kid. I should watch it again, actually. I gotta watch that again now.
Yeah, I would say take a poll and see if anybody else in the inner giz hive has not seen it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and have everybody and just all watch it together. And
maybe we'll watch it on tour. We'll watch it on tour. That'd be good.
Yeah, there's a box set shaped like a drum with a tambourine on top that has hours and hours of outtakes.
Oh, yeah.
Including people who didn't get in, or somebody wouldn't sign the contract at the time. Creedence Clearwater was there, who were barely remembered as a live band. Johnny Winter was just coming up. The Grateful Dead are there in the middle of the night, and I think they're trying to save power because you can barely even see them. And they got stuck in one of their little rabbit holes where they're kind of grooving on something that to me wasn't that interesting. And about 15 minutes later, I gave up.
Yeah.
And I couldn't take that anymore. I don't know if you're a Deadhead person or not, but you know, I'm mostly not.
I'm a newer Deadhead, Jello. Like I sort of it recently clicked, and it's funny. This has happened to me a lot of times where we'll be making some music, and a lot of people will say the same thing. They'll say, "This record that you made sounds like this." And I'll be like, I never listened to that. And then I go and listen to it because all these people have said so. And I'm like, actually, this is pretty sick, you know. And then it sort of kind of goes around in a weird way. But I think just touring the States a lot, obviously the Dead are just culturally significant thing. In Australia, it's, you know, here we know a few of the hits. I thought they were a country band, you know, like I know the... Working Man's Dead and the American Beauty studio, some of the studio stuff I would have heard, and it's rad. They're great songs, but that was kind of what I thought.
They were
Dead
garage band early on under the name of Warlocks.
Too. Yeah, yeah, and I know all that now, but it's kind of because touring the States, it would be like I swear to God, every second person would come and be like, you guys remind me of the Grateful Dead. I'm like, I've never listened to the Grateful Dead. You know, like, it's a coincidence. I don't know. And then eventually...
It's probably a good way to have that infect you after you're already very much got your own thing, or in your case, things, down ahead of time.
Well, I think when you say the word jam in America, it specifically means a certain style of improvising, which is kind of influenced by that. And I didn't know that. Because we always said the word jam, and here it just it just means improvising. You know, it just means kind of going off the script. And in America, it means a different thing.
Right. It especially popped up after Jerry Garcia died and more bands were trying to be the Grateful Dead, Fish being the next big one. But my old hometown is one of the Boulder is one of the ground zero places for that, where you can't go two blocks without bumping into another jam band, if not a bluegrass band. And two of the big ones, maybe more Leftover Salmon and String Cheese Incident, who are also gigantic bands now, are without any like much radio play, or I hardly ever see card copies of anything they've ever made, and they fill basketball arenas or three nights someplace on New Year's Eve in San Francisco or Colorado or something, and it's the jam band scene. And I ask people in Europe if this goes on there too, and they say no.
It's very, very interesting. It's very specifically American kind of phenomenon. It's fascinating. I've never listened to really any of the other jam band scene. I've never been involved or a part of it or understood it at all. But yeah, very, very recently I've kind of, the Dead clicked. I just figured out that if you find a song that you like, you can kind of listen to 100 different versions of it. And that's kind of cool to me, because I'm the sort of person who, when I find a song I like, or an album I like, I'm likely to only listen to that for like a few days. You know, I sort of do that. I sort of obsess over things like that. And in a way, they're kind of a good band for me, because instead of just listening to the same exact recording, I can listen to like 100 different versions of it. And that's pretty cool.
So did you guys start letting people put out all these different semi-official bootlegs of you because of that, or did that just happen anyway?
That also just happened anyway, and I know that, I mean, you know, I think we must have picked up on some things related to the Dead culture and taping culture accidentally. I do remember that very early on, when we were still doing the same set every night and all of that, we would have tapers come to the show. I was always like, what the fuck are they doing? Like, this is weird. We played the same set last night and a taper came to that too. Like, can't they just listen to that? It doesn't make any sense. And then eventually I started feeling kind of sorry for them, because these people would kind of come to multiple nights, or they'd follow us around, or they'd drive in their RV and come to multiple shows. And we do say for a few sections, more or less the same show every night. But they must have seen something in us where we were kind of on some sort of improv tip or something. I don't know. But I started feeling sorry for him. I was like, fuck, we need to kind of put on a bit of a different show for these RV crew here, you know, tonight. They've been to the last six shows.
But was Red Rocks the first time you ever tried three-hour shows of all different songs?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, nothing. We haven't done anything like that. We had experimented quite a few times with, you know, we probably would have played three shows in a row without repeating songs, but never 3 hour shows each. And we never advertised such. We never did three in one place. It was never kind of a thing. It was just in the past, it's like, well, we're trying to keep our own brains active as well, trying to ward off the dementia and all of that, you know, just trying to keep the brain going.
Well, in some ways it rescues me from that. It's like, oh my God, I'm really getting into music again now. Wow. Cool. So, So left-handed guitar and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
I assume you play right-handed with the low E string on top and not on the bottom.
Yeah, so...
Was guitar your first instrument?
No, actually. I thought guitar was boring because Dad played it. You know, typical. And maybe I was 10 or 12 or something, and I started getting drum lessons, which I loved. I really, really loved. I think I was drawn to the obnoxiousness of drums, maybe the immediacy and the loudness, you know, of all of that. I did love it, but it didn't click the same way as the guitar did. There was, fortunately for me, there was guitars around the house. Always acoustic, but there was guitars around the house, and they were all upside down. So I sort of just, I don't know, would from time to time pick them up and, oh, what's this thing do? Or what's this, you know, what's this weird peg? You know, what's this string? Like, what sound does it make when you do this sort of thing? So sort of maybe had that on my side. But yeah, like I said before, I really did get into music before I got into playing music. Something happened and I just became obsessed with music. And it was all I really thought about. It was all I really cared about. It was all I really did was just listen to music.
So how were your grades?
Oh, probably. The thing with me at school was I liked some things in school, but and the things I liked, I probably was okay at. But if I decided that something wasn't important, well, I just wouldn't go. Like, I failed heaps of stuff, but it's not because I couldn't do it. Maybe I could if I tried. I just didn't want to. I don't know. It's actually a bad habit.
Parents were free enough with you. They didn't just freak out if your grades weren't good and you had it. I did not have that luxury, nor did I want to have parents who would ever allow me to play drums or even guitar unless it was acoustic and I was playing folk songs, which wasn't me. So at least there was still something there burning inside, so to speak. But meanwhile, after the Royal Melbourne, what is it, Institute of Technology or something like, yeah, Institute of Technology, somehow the Giz went from a freelance, even, well, tell me about the story. How did you rise and get so big from so far under the radar? I don't recall hit singles or music videos, let alone Pepsi commercials or skateboard videos. And even when I went to Australia and then couple times in the 2010s, went to record stores, I never saw any of your records, and nobody mentioned you. And yet, by the time I finally get the Mind Fuzz album, oh my God, they're playing in town, they're playing there, they're that big, how did this happen? And how did this happen?
I mean, it feels like we did one little step at a time. It feels like that. We also never did anything commercial, I mean, on purpose. A, it felt like we didn't want to. I didn't care about that
shit. Right.
And B, I don't think anyone was interested. And B, I don't think anyone was interested anyway. Our music's always been kind of weird and hard to put down, and we're all pretty vagrant, vagabond types. No one wants to put us on a Pepsi commercial. Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, more to the point, how did all these people find out about you? It's not as though your following isn't growing by leaps and bounds either. All internet? Is it all social media or what?
I don't know, really. I don't know. But I will. All I know is that we have played a lot of shows. We've pretty much constantly toured as much as we can afford to, and also our lives will permit before we go insane, really, as much as we can over the last 12 years or whatever it's been now. And we've really just made as much music as we can. It's really all we've done.
You're very good at that.
Thanks.
Crazy good at that. But we'll get to a little more of that in a minute. But even so, very small. I mean, Willoughby's Beach, your first vinyl release, was started out as a 300-copy edition 10-inch. And, yeah. And you know, what was the next one? What was a 12-bar Bruise? It was in the pizza box.
Oh, yeah.
And not very many of those. And then somehow, kaboom. And even now, or especially I noticed this when they did the San Francisco shows and the Flightless had just reissued all these earlier albums, that a lot of them were limited editions of 3,000, 5,000, or is that just one edition and you'd sell tens of thousands more of them? I don't know.
I mean, I think if you looked at any one of our individual records, they're not huge selling pressings or anything. But there are fucking fair few of them now. So a fair few albums out there. I guess it all adds up. We've made enough money to just pay the bills and tour and travel and see the world and meet people and make music with our best mates. And that's kind of the way I've really thought of it. It's truly, truly strange when people turn up to the show. You know, like anyone turns up. I'm sure you can kind of like relate to how it feels when you turn up to a city that you haven't been to before and there's people there. It's like, how the fuck did they get here? How do they know who we are? This is weird. I guess like my answer to your question is I've no idea. You know, I've no idea really.
Because also, you know, you had this self-contained hive, this self-contained machine. You didn't have some big showbiz manager. You had your own studio, your own label, your own management, all in-house. One guy doing the art, and I believe the film, too, and the lights. Doesn't Jason do all of that?
Yeah, Jace has done all of our album covers, a lot of our music videos, pretty much most of any iconography or anything you would kind of visually sort of group with King Giz is Jace. He also travels with us and does the projections and the screen and all of that show, which is just insanely amazing as well, and such a unique thing. It's so Jason. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I just was, you know, even in 2019, I was like, oh, my God, they've got this whole huge operation. And there's these other killer bands on Flightless. There's all these things going on. And the band is the boss. It's not the, and the people working back in Melbourne were working for you guys. And somehow you kept it all together and stuff. I'm just still amazed by that. I know there's been some changes, and we'll get to that. You know, and you went from the garage stuff, and then Eyes Like the Sky, proper album number two. I'm going to go through some of those now, too, where I think it was Joey who alluded to a band we're working with now called Spindrift.
Oh, yeah.
As a major inspiration for that particular project, complete with what I guess might be a cowboy poet or author of stories doing the vocals and the narration about the American West, not the Australian.
Yeah. West. I think, you know, it makes me feel old thinking about all that stuff, because we were, I mean, between 18 and 21, I guess, when we made that album. We're kids.
Wow.
And it felt like a logical genre to explore, or a logical sound to go for, which in hindsight is bizarre. But I think we were listening to a lot of spaghetti Western stuff. I've always been a fan of like Morricone and all of that kind of thing, and surf music as well, which kind of bleeds into that, you know, watching cowboy movies and everything as well. It made sense. It was like, I don't know, I think someone had shown me Spindrift at some point as well, and I was like, this is really cool, this is really sick. And I think I just thought that other people made music like that too, but not many people do. So we just made an album like that without thinking about it too much.
Yeah, if I ever saw them, they were more of a space rock band.
Right.
With a little bit of Native American stuff going on, and the discovery of Morricone, and they went way far down that rabbit hole before I kind of helped coax them out of it, and they made their Psyxploitation Lava Lamp album for us, which still has plenty of their Morricone-inspired stuff on it, too. They think it's their best record, and I think so, too.
Right.
And, okay, next, I believe it's next, was Float Along, Fill Your Lungs, and at least the Flightless reissue, you did like very friendly person-to-person liner notes on a lot of these, signed Love Stew at the end, which is, I think, maybe part of your appeal too, is, you know, you're nice people on top of it all as well. So you know that, and people get that. But Float Along, Fill Your Lungs, your liner notes said, this is the record where we started to play together for the first time. What did you mean by that? How were you not playing together before then?
I think for all the records before this, it was very much someone, usually me, and increasingly the other guys, but at least at the start it was usually me, would come in with a constructed song, and I'd say, this is how it all goes, and we'd play it. And but a lot of it was overdubbed and that sort of thing too, and there was no real listening to each other. It's sort of people playing their parts and sort of
overdubbing at different times. So
yeah, overdubbing at different times. I mean, it was recorded like some of both Willoughby's Beach and 12 Bar Brews were recorded live to a degree, but a lot of things were overdubbed as well. It was just constructed like a recording, I suppose. Like,
right.
It was just what we did, or how those records were made. And when we played live, we played our parts, and we're playing in, you know, fucking tiny spaces, and we had no idea how to communicate with sound engineers or anything, and you can't hear anything. You can't hear anything, like anything. And, you know, you're just up there fucking making noise, and you hope that it sounds good for the audience, because it sounds shit for you, you know, and you just cross your fingers and hope for the best. And I think when we got to this record, we started to set up a little bit quieter, try and listen to each other, try and improvise a bit. You know, Head on Pill, the first song on there, is a huge improvisation, really, on just one chord.
Was that the first time you tapped into the Hawkwind vein? I didn't get to re-listen to 12 Bar Blues before we got here tonight.
I think I probably had heard Hawkwind before. I definitely was listening to a lot of Noi and like other kind of krautrocky stuff that has that endless groove.
Hypnotic.
I don't remember being into Hawkwind until a little later. I think Hawkwind was definitely an influence over Nonagon Infinity. Definitely, definitely for sure. Because I remember listening to it in the studio when we were making it, when we were warming up or when we were setting up and stuff.
Yeah, I assume you record and mix real quick too.
It depends. It depends. Like, we've had, I'd say most of our records still take from sort of Genesis to completion 2 years, really, most of the time, which I think is probably pretty typical of most bands and artists and songwriters. And I still think that's just about how long it takes, but I think we usually have got a couple on the go and they've got overlap, and sometimes we'll be in a really intensive period where we're just focusing on one, but that usually is only going to last a month or maybe two at a time.
It was a Float Along, or was it Mind Fuzz? I think it was Mind Fuzz, the next one, where the different place of recording, some of it you recorded it with Daptone.
Oh yeah.
The Daptone studio.
Yeah, so we were fans of Daptone and just all the like amazing soul music they were making. I guess not in a way that was necessarily influencing us musically, but definitely sonically. Those records sounded fucking amazing and so cool. And I think particularly at this time, actually, you know, now too, more or less, we weren't listening to any modern music at all. We were listening to music from the 60s primarily. And probably until about late 70s maybe is what we're listening to at the time. We had a narrow, like, sort of sliver of influence.
Well, not narrow, because so many amazing things were going on and music changed so much.
It sure
from
did.
The early 1960s to the late 1960s, and then again until in the late 70s when it was dying out. Then I come on the scene and really depressed until punk happened. And then, I wasn't born too late. I was born at the perfect time. And then again, there were so many things coming out at once. You never knew what was coming next. Gang of Four, Bauhaus, Bad Brains, Mission of Burma, and even some people were playing strict surf instrumentals again, which hadn't been done since the early 60s, and much, much, much more.
Cool time.
And I think it was that one, or maybe one of the next one. Oh, yeah, this was recorded here, and then this was recorded by one member on his phone in his hotel room, and then this was that. And the ones that were recorded on a phone don't sound like they were just recorded on a little phone or something. It all still fits as a full sounding album and things.
I think at this time,
you're very good at that.
with Mindfuzz and Quarters and even to a degree Nonagon Infinity and Oddments and Float Along Feelungs and the records at this time, the main mode of experimentation was recording, and it was sonic. And that's why we're attracted to Daptone, and that's kind of why we're very lucky to get to work there. Actually, we had a friend in an Australian band who was in this band UMI. I don't know if you ever remember them.
No, I don't.
He was working there, and we happened to be in New York, and I was like, Rusty, can we record at Daptone? And he's like, that would be pretty random, but you know, I'll see what I can do. And he managed to tee up a recording session, and it was pretty cool. We got to know a few of the crew in there and had such an amazing time. But we're attracted to the sound and working with tape machines and like all this old gear and all this old stuff, which just felt so science fiction, and you're just inside a massive spaceship or something.
Well, part of it also, here's one from the phone, this is going on, here's one from Daptone. Your refusal to limit yourselves genre-wise, sonically, or anything else is a major part of the beauty of what you guys put together.
Thanks, Jello.
Ultimately. So I also noticed up to and kind of even through there, you weren't really paying that much attention to the lyrics. Some of the very early songs have one line for the whole song or something, and kind of a lot of lysergic stream of consciousness stuff and the occasional she done me wrong, one or two sentences. And it didn't seem till it was Paper Mache Dream Balloon, where you went a completely different direction, I think, from Mind Fuzz, can't remember. Kind of got two piles of these at home. The ones I really, really liked and the ones I wasn't as into right off the bat. And I can't remember which one that was in, but that was when the lyrics first started to focus on bigger things and more writing and seemed like trying to write better and be more conscious of what was coming out of there. And then next album, one of my favorites, of course, was the Flying Microtonal Banana album, which is when your eco-disaster songs began, it seems. You know, with, you know, very, very aware of how much danger our planet is in, and then all kinds of different worst-case scenarios, sometimes science fiction-y imagination things going on. And it just kind of grew from there, lyrically. But of course, why it's called a Flying Microtonal Banana is a picture of one of your guitars on there. I guess one of three and only three you own or something. We've talked about this a lot, but what are microtones?
I guess a microtone is a note inside a note, or a note between a note, or a pitch that's between two of our regular Western pitches, which are usually stuck together. And I guess in Western music, in Western culture, we have 12 fixed pitches, then they repeat. But in other cultures, that's not the case. The 12 isn't sacred. You know, there's some benefits of 12 and there's some reasons why we landed on 12, but it doesn't mean that it's the only way that you can write music. And I do really think that we're limited by only having the 12 and by only having exposure to 12. And that's not to say that, I mean, I make heaps of music in just 12 tone equal temperament, which is what microtonal nerds like me would call it. It's great and it's practical and stuff, but there's just worlds and worlds and worlds of sonic opportunities out there. And
right.
we retrofitted some instruments to do 24 tones an octave, which means that there's a note exactly in between, 50% in between every single, if we want to call it a regular note. And I like 24, actually. And there are an infinite amount of tuning possibilities, but I like 24, actually.
So is this straight, shall we say, Mid-Eastern scale, or is that something else again?
We were influenced by Turkish music. And I think the crossover was there was a lot of amazing psychedelic Turkish music from the 70s that we were listening to. And then it clicked that part of the sound was that it wasn't tuned to Western instruments, or it wasn't. And it clicked, and I was like, that's why I like it. That's why it sounds so exotic. I need to figure out how to do that.
A friend of mine who who I met in Colorado even before punk or anything, we're still close friends, and he became a master engineer, producer, and guitar player, keyboards, and pretty damn good at that too. And one day I walk into his little basement studio, and there was an instrument like nothing I'd ever seen before. Oh yeah, I got that in Turkey. I think it was a saz.
Sick.
And he said he picked it up and started playing around with it. Oh yeah, and this note are not even in a Western scale. It's only here that I can play this note.
Yeah, and I will say that Turkish music isn't in 24 tones an octave. We had to pick.
Yeah, that was my question. Yeah.
So we had to pick a tuning which felt practical for us to make a record together. You know, and also we just had to pick. We had to pick one. But I don't know, we're some sort of bastardized fucking, you know, some sort of weird wrong thing that we're doing. But it felt right to us at the time. I like 24 because you have the original 12, which to a Western ear sound in tune. And then you have 12, which are the most out of tune possible because they're the most exactly in between, you know, the other 12. And I like that. I like that ability to be really in tune and really out of tune at the same time. So anyway, 24 is cool.
So the one that looks like one of those EKO Eco brand guitars that the Italians made in the 60s, the beige one, the flying banana, if you will. And Joey had something similar. I finally realized with all these frets that I didn't see on normal guitars. They usually were playing them at the same time. And the Middle Eastern inspired stuff, because you play it so heavy a lot of the time, is my second favorite side of your sound from the full-on blasting Hawkwindy space rock and stuff. That's my second favorite. And those were usually the guitars there. Did you build those yourselves?
No, we didn't. I had a very serendipitous moment. I was starting to kind of get into this microtonal... I was starting to go down the microtonal rabbit hole. I didn't really know what I was doing. It felt like I discovered something which no one else knew about. I felt like I was on some conspiracy theory tip or something. It was like, shouldn't everyone know about this? This is crazy. I went to music school. No one told me about this. What the fuck? You know, it was like that. And yeah, I had this sort of serendipitous moment where I was actually at a show. I was just at the pub and a guy who I hadn't met before, who's now become a bit of a friend, he approached me and said, "Oh, I make guitars. Can I make one for you? I like your band." And I was like, fuck yeah, that's unbelievable. No one's ever said that to me before. That's so cool. Of course, like, I will never turn down a guitar. That's amazing. And then I got chatting and I was like, do you know what? I'm kind of obsessed with this microtonal thing at the moment. Do you think we could make it microtonal? And he was like, I have no idea what that means, but let me do some research. And so we sort of had to come up with a fretting arrangement. It actually is based on a SARS, because I'd bought a SARS in Turkey maybe 6 months before that when I was on vacation over there and was playing it at home and having a lot of fun with it. But it's a 20, it's again bastardized, but it's a 24 fret an octave version of a SARS. We had to change the fretting arrangement a few times to kind of get it right, a bit of trial and error. But once we had this guitar in hand, it might have been maybe the most inspired I've ever felt, I think, in my whole life. It was just like, instantly, it was just like, as soon as the guitar was in my hands, it was just like the ideas were just, it was just so easy. It was like, I know how to play guitar, so I've kind of got this leg up on it. And I've been listening to all this kind of like Turkish and by this time kind of Persian music and Arabic music and Indian music and stuff. And so it was just like I had a new, it's like I could see a new color. It's like I was painting with all these new paintbrushes, you know. It's just the coolest thing.
And so does Cookie have one too?
The three of us all have one. When we made that,
does Lukey have to have a special bass for this, or can
Lukey has a bass too? And we've worked out over the years a few different ways to tune keyboards and stuff too. And Ambrose has a few specially tuned harmonicas as well.
All the benefits of not, because I read an interview with Joey where there's all kinds of music theory stuff in there, you know, especially on the, the Lava Magma, whatever album and stuff. We'll get to that. But I was like, God, I don't want to think about this when I listen to the Giz or any other band. It just is. That's the, you know, same as the music obsessions you had as a kid till now. Same deal. So I must compliment you for being that schooled in those things and not letting music theory get in your way.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, I actually the music school he went to wasn't really a music school. It was kind of an arts degree.
Well, let's hold that thought for a minute because we've hit on about the 1 hour mark.
Oh yeah,
this
cool.
This is going to come out at a part one and a part two, and okay, who knows what else if we keep going. So stay tuned for the next hour, boys, girls, and those who identify otherwise, animal, vegetable, mineral, and we will be back.